At AJ Products, we're dedicated to delivering intelligent solutions tailored for your business needs. Specializing in warehouse and project planning, we bring efficiency and sustainability to the forefront. To elevate your business, visit ajproducts.ie.
It's Friday, February the 16th, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics Wrap of the Week from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. Jack Horgan-Jones and Cormac McQuinn are here to discuss the events and the issues of the week. Hello to you both.
Good afternoon, Hugh.
Hello, Hugh.
Cormac, you had the pleasure, as did I, of observing 3.5 hours of testimony before the Oireachtas Media Committee in relation to which scandal are we on now, or which report are we on now? Report number 5, scandal number 7, largely dealing with the fallout from the Toy Show, the musical debacle, and parting payments to the former chief financial officer. It did go on a bit, didn't it?
It did. I mean, the TDs like and senators for that matter like their moment in the sun, and RT has provided them with several opportunities for that over the last few months, given all the controversies that have happened. This is probably unless some of the witnesses that declined to attend, you know, have a change of heart, this is probably the last gasp for the politicians to have public hearings on all of these things. So it's not too surprising that they may have milked it a bit and the meeting went on quite a long time. To give them some credit, though, there was some new information for the public there. You know, for instance, there's been a lot of speculation in recent months as to what the exit package was for RT's former chief financial officer, Breed O'Keefe. Kevin Backhurst put the figure on it, €450,000. Audible gasps within the committee room. It's a big number.
Demurred as well, which I thought was good. He first said, "No, I can't. I couldn't possibly."
Yes,
and it wasn't exactly dragged out of him.
That was interesting. What did you make of that? The fact that he said no and then he said yes.
I don't know. I thought it was weird in the moment, and I thought that, like, I mean, look, I'm sure you could find some kind of technical explanation as to why this is the case.
Well, I think the explanation he gave from it, because he was pressed hard later. Once another piece of information which came out was that there had been an exit package paid to the head of strategy, Rory Coveney. Yeah. That was not information we've seen previously. And he refused to divulge that sum. And I think I recall him saying that he was in a position to divulge Breed O'Keefe's payment because she had already acknowledged it.
She had already acknowledged the existence of the
public
payment?
No, that she had already acknowledged the sum. That was my understanding of his explanation.
Right, okay. I wasn't aware that she had acknowledged the sum, because certainly the first time I'd heard 450,000, because one of the things that did strike me, and I wasn't watching it as closely as you guys because I wasn't covering it, but it did strike me that it was weird that he seemed to create this kind of dogleg between, you know, admitting under very small amounts of duress exactly the sum that was involved for Breed O'Keefe, but holding the line on Rory Coveney and saying absolutely, absolutely not.
And potentially others.
So then that kind of unspooled into, like, as is the nature of this scandal or this series of scandals or saga. It's probably a saga at this stage, is it?
It's definitely a saga.
It's definitely a saga. You know, it just kind of keeps giving and keeps...
Minister Catherine Martin was talking to him afterwards, and
he said he'll
go back to the lawyers.
An undertaking to get updated legal advice,
which I suspect will be the exact.
We still can't reveal these details. Maybe that will be the end of it. But the politicians are like a dog with a bone on this thing, aren't they? So there will be pressure over the next while on certainly Rory Coveney's exit package, but potentially others as well, because there have been a number of departures from RTE in the last year or so.
So what are we to make of all this? If this is the last one, what are we to make
we've said
of...
That before.
Yeah, we have said that before.
Well, and the Public Accounts Committee aren't finished their deliberations on whether they might have RTE back in as well, but they'll need special permission to do that.
But as many people pointed out, the big missing bit at the moment are the people who have not appeared before the committee, primarily, first and foremost, the former Director General, Dee Forbes, who has been, says she is unable to make herself available for medical reasons. She's by far the most significant one. But even to have Rory Coveney there yesterday, I think would have been rather useful, given that there was so much focus on Toy Show the Musical, and there was it was clear to me that some of the people who were there from RTE were not very happy with the way this had been handled by Rory Coveney, and in fact, you know, went right up to the line of saying that you know, they had been misled.
Yeah, which is the risk of not turning up. I mean, if you look at it from Rory Coveney's point of view, what would be the percentage in him going? I mean, he's gone before. He was interrogated over Toy Show the Musical and so on when he was an employee of RTE. He then resigned. He was invited back in, but he's now, for all intents and purposes, a private citizen. So why would he go? the risk then in not going is that you do kind of open yourself up to the possibility of being thrown under the next passing bus during the committee sessions, you know. So
on the other hand, you ask why would he go? He'd go because he was a public servant for 10 years and under his watch something happened, which is a legitimate subject of public inquiry and concern. You'd go for that reason.
How very idealistic of you, Hugh.
But also, you might end up drawing a line under the whole thing, and were he so inclined, he could say, my exit package was such and such, however many thousand euros, and that's the end of that story.
That is the reason
it's another reason to go.
To stop the bleeding. And if he did want to kind of stop the bleeding, rip off the band-aid, whatever construction you want to put in it, he could come out at any stage and say it. And like we were saying, myself and Cormac in the office during the week, like, I mean, Simon Coveney probably asked about this, you know, like this is something that might just kind of keep on, Simon Coveney, obviously Rory Coveney's brother, might just kind of keep on just kind of bleeding and, you know, until there's a full stop put at the end of that
sentence.
Or
there's the other option open to those who didn't attend, which is submit the written answers to the committees. Those answers, I can assure you, will find their way into the public domain or they'll be discussed in an open session of a committee. And that's the other thing. It's not a good look unless there are genuine reasons to not be engaging at this point.
The other thing I wonder about this is the broader picture of, there's been a lot of talk about the culture of RTE, undue deference to the chief executive or the director general, perhaps a culture of going around processes or not following processes properly, or indeed possibly misleading people. And that goes right back to the original Tuberty payments thing, which kicked all of this off. But because these key individuals are not present, one is kind of forced to accept that the culture resided with those three small number of individuals. But I wonder about that.
It's not really, you know, how culture works, though,
no,
is it?
No, a culture doesn't work like that. But so they function as a kind of a dead end on the investigation. Mm. It would seem to me, looking at it, that the cultural problems in RTE ran a lot deeper than one or two individuals who happened to be in certain jobs for the last five or six years.
Thankfully, we have yet another report coming into the culture of RTE.
Many more reports due. There's the two expert group commission reports for the government. There's presumably the media committee will do a report. The public accounts committee was nearly finished their report when the two other reports on Toy Show the Musical and the exit packages were published. So that's going to be another one. So that's four reports anyway coming down the line. I mean, this is not going away anytime soon.
But one of the things that I found funny this week as well, unless I'm misremembering, one of the Catherine Martin commissioned reports is into the culture of RTE, and the proffered reason as to why the government haven't made a decision on the RTE future funding model is because they're waiting for these reports into the culture. I mean, does a report into the culture and governance of RTE necessarily enable you all of a sudden to make a funding decision? I mean, are they not kind of formally separate things? And also, the existence of a report on the culture of RTE, it doesn't actually change the culture of RTE overnight. I mean, if it comes out and says the culture of RTE is rotten from top to bottom and it isn't rooted in any individual and, you know, there needs to be a total overhaul of the culture, like, can you then in good faith go ahead and say, right, okay, on that basis, let's make a big decision on the future funding model?
The likely fig leaf which will be given to the government when it comes to, and we'll come to this question of the funding in a moment, is that there will almost certainly, arising out of that, be some sort of recommendations for new forms of oversight of the way that RTE does its business. They've already brought it in under a new era. There's talk about, you know, other elements of the state having an oversight role, changing, if you like, the structures of the relationship between the state and
it may,
and
it may also, and this is just a pet theory, I'm not basing this on any kind of you know, behind the scenes chat or anything like that, but it may provide the kind of reason for a big dramatic gesture, like just get rid of the board, you know, something like that.
Right, okay, well, that might do it. I mean, it does bring us to, I mean, there's a huge irony here, it seems to me, because I've written about RTE over the years in one capacity or another, which is that the previous regime, the chair, Moya Doherty, and the DG, Dee Forbes, spent 5 or 6 years literally banging their heads off the wall of Leinster House, trying to argue for exactly the changes which now seem to be actually the subject of real debate, and they failed to do so. And now, as a result of the catastrophic events during the final years of their regime, those things are finally being taken seriously. So in a way, fair play to them. They got where they wanted to get to with RTE's funding.
It was actually an interesting exchange early on in the committee meeting on Wednesday where Fine Gael TD Brendan Griffin was challenging Kevin Backhurst on why he stopped paying for advertising to outside platforms, so presumably other radio stations, other TV channels, on the licence fee, on encouraging people to pay the licence fee. And Backhurst was insisting interesting was because it would have been tone deaf to be demanding that people pay the fee at the time when RT was in the midst of controversies. But Griffin went further and suggested that, you know, it might have been part of a strategy to allow the licence fee revenues to collapse. Now, Backhurst categorically denied that, but, you know, it does speak to that, that irony of the overhaul of the licence fee system that RT has always wanted may well now happen because of all of this disaster that has befallen the national broadcaster.
So it was very notable to me at the committee meeting that apart from the first Sinn Féin contribution, which was from Imelda Munster, the later ones from Fintan Warfield and I think Thomas Gould were barely questions at all. They were just putting out the new Sinn Féin party line, which was presented this week, which is about the solution to this problem is to move immediately, forthwith, to direct exchequer funding and to let everybody off who hasn't paid their licence fee.
Mm. Well, I defer to you guys, but did they talk about the amnesty that much in the committee? Because by that stage, it was already imploding a little bit.
Yeah, no, not the amnesty so much. It was more the direct exchequer funding.
Is the amnesty a political mistake?
Yeah, big
absolutely.
One, I think so,
yeah. I mean, don't get away from the fact that the majority of people still pay their TV license, and that is infuriating to people. If you say, well, okay, if you didn't pay, you know, that's all right, we're giving you an amnesty. You know, the majority of people still forked out that €160 every year. It's perhaps a bit of a sign of panic within Sinn Féin at this something of a trend now in falling poll numbers as the local elections approach. It's a very much, you know, here's an idea that'll be popular in some sections, but it mightn't do anything to grow their support.
Yeah. Do you agree with that?
I do. Yeah, very much so. Because they put down the motion for debate on, I think it was Tuesday, and you know it was a fairly pro forma way to kind of move the agenda on to a discussion of RTE and put the government under pressure over the handling of it and various inadequacies and so on. There was no need, I think, to put in this amnesty thing. Like it was totally superfluous, and it immediately offered the government a foothold to shift the narrative on. Gleeful on, yeah.
Gleeful
and it was Tuesday morning, Leo Varadkar on his way into cabinet. Actually, I think Monday night they started putting out this statement about, you know, this is a slap in the face to people who have paid their licence fee. So they recognised the opportunity straight away and picked up the ball and ran from it. And it just took the sheen off the whole Sinn Féin strategy for the week when it came to RTE. They had to kind of quietly, if not ditch it, then certainly not emphasise it as much later on in the week during the debates and during the committee appearances. And it just kind of, it reminds me a little bit of, to use a footballing analogy, like, you know, when a striker is short on confidence and they scuff their shot in front of goal, like everything can get kind of line, and you still contrive a way to kind of make it less than it should be.
So this is because of a number of events, not least our opinion poll last week, which showed a substantial fall in Sinn Féin support.
That's a trend, right? I mean, like it's kind of been
across a number of polls,
yeah. And it's something that we talked about a couple of weeks ago. You know, maybe the saliency of the housing issue is not quite what it was, even though it still seems to be an overriding concern when people rank their concerns. I think like there's not too many news cycles that are taken over by housing these days.
And they didn't handle the aftermath of the Dublin riot well.
Look, like there's a kind of, you know, there's a stock, you know, critique of Sinn Féin at the moment, which says that they're struggling on immigration because the base is more conservative than the kind of more recent Arab East parts of their voting support. And I think that you know, you're just seeing an expression of that at the moment.
But it was a fluffing of what should have been an open goal for them in a way. I mean, call for exchequer funding for the licence fee. It's a classic opposition. Yeah. Call for something that you know is probably coming down the line anyway. And then you can say, oh, well, we looked for that.
Yeah. And it also happens to be the absence of a charge on households. You know, like in the round, people pay through taxes. But
sure.
I mean, you wouldn't have to pay your TV licence fee. So
can I get some insight, if an insight is available, into what state the debate is really at? Are we going to get a decision from this government on funding public service broadcasting, and is it tending, as it looks to me from looking from the outside, it is a little bit more towards the direct funding model than it was a few months ago?
One thing that struck me during the week was Leo Varadkar was talking about the various options during leaders' questions, and aside from the options that are there, one being exchequer funding or, you know, another being a broadcasting charge, none of them are particularly palatable. But aside from that, he said, we'll be making a decision on that in the coming weeks. And then he said, or the coming months, just to give that little bit of leeway on timing, you know. Will there be a decision before the local elections? Well, that'd be very curious to see a new form of tax or broadcasting charge or whatever they decide to land on is not going to be terribly popular for the government parties as people go to the polls.
But we know that
Catherine Martin's been talking about the summer. Now, the summer could be the summer before the local elections in June, or it could be
end of August.
Yeah. But it's certainly something. They keep talking about where the government is going to grasp the nettle. Well, if they're actually going to do it, they will have to do it before an election. It's going to be a question of which one.
Where do the two finance and finance-related ministers, Pascal Donoghue and Michael McGrath, stand on it? They seem to be the ones, who are most publicly opposed to
significant change. That's a function of their briefs as well, I think.
They don't want to find 150 million euro odd every year.
Totally.
As they're looking for hundreds of millions for other things elsewhere.
Yeah. I suspect that ultimately they'll row in behind their respective leadership positions, and there's been some reporting that Varadkar, the Taoiseach, is leaning towards a exchequer funding model, although he was quite critical of an exchequer funding model in the Dáil this week, which may have been in service of a political point, because he was saying I wouldn't trust the Shiners basically to run it. But if he does, I suspect Pascal Donoghue will row in line behind that. But Micheál Martin has been very clear that he doesn't favour it, to the extent that it would be kind of hard for him to walk it back.
And he says
from here,
that one
and Michael
of the reasons,
McGrath, I'd say instinctively, yeah, and he says institutionally, the Department of Finance would aid it.
He doesn't favour it because he thinks it would bring, he favours the arm's length relationship.
Yeah.
And he thinks that this would undermine that. And, God knows, we look around the world, just look at, coverage of what's been happening in Poland over the last while. You know, terrible things can happen when governments get their claws
into public service. We will end up, where either, something goes to the leaders on a Monday night, or some version of that, the leaders meeting on Monday night, and they thrash it out. And if they can't get an agreement there, then it'll be just kicked to touch. I think
so you still think there's reasonable odds that it will be kicked to touch and they won't do anything before the end of this. I wouldn't discount it.
I mean, it would be a situation now where if it were kicked to touch, it would be deeply embarrassing for Catherine Martin amongst everyone else who has put a big political stamp on, being the government that grasps the nettle. That's the phrase that she keeps on using. But at what cost? And if you can't achieve a consensus or, a serviceable fudge, what options are left?
And isn't that the pragmatic thing almost to do? If they can't reach a consensus, go to the, it wouldn't be the issue they go to the country on. But
no.
But if they have an earlier election, they can say, well, there's... We're on the way out the door. We shouldn't be making this decision. It's up to the next government. And people might say that's cowardly or whatever. But people would also not care pretty soon after that. And but would probably be happy when there's no new tax coming, at least before this election. The parties would all be forced to put in their manifestos what they would do.
There's probably a threshold as well on how much people care about this story anymore. Although I was saying that at the start of this week, and then the 450,000 thing came out, and it was genuinely, I think, a matter of public interest and interest to the public. But I do think that you have a point that, at some point people will stop caring, which opens up the space for a kick to touch or a fudge. But, they would have to back away from their stated intentions.
You could get 20 years of TV license fees out of the cost of the Children's Hospital, which now officially stands at...
Have you done the maths on that?
2.3 billion. Okay. 20 years of... Yeah, it would be about 120 million a year or thereabouts, so you get a single building with 380 hospital beds for children, which is obviously very welcome when it opens.
Two satellite centres.
But not at that price. I'm tempted to utter an expletive, but JFC, how did it come to this?
I don't know, there's a book on that, isn't there?
I think Jared Harlan had a piece on our opinion pages today, which kind of set out his take on how it came to that.
Yes, and it's a very interesting breakdown of the
whole process and how the Paediatric Hospital Development Board has basically been put there as a mudguard for politicians and civil servants to get this thing over the line, which this thing that has been beset by delays and difficulties and spiraling costs, and by no means is that 2.2 billion necessarily going to be the final figure. There are still active claims by the developer against the development board in terms of extra costs that they feel they should be entitled to.
And there's kind of complications in terms of the various current children's hospitals, which they have to feed into this new structure and staffing it and making all that stuff work.
They have to merge three hospitals into one, and that's not necessarily going to be a smooth process. I did a calculation for the Fix newsletter that we do on a Friday, which, the Paediatric Hospital Development Board was set up in 2007. So a child born that year will be 18 by the time the hospital opens in 2025, meaning they will never have the benefit of that aside from their own children in years to come. You know, it takes an entire generation of children to get something done in this country by the looks of it, you know. We've seen that at the Children's Hospital. We've seen it in Metrolink, Metro North, that sort of thing. It's been quite a sorry tale, really, when you think about it, albeit at the very end of it, there will be a state-of-the-art facility, which, you know, everyone will be happy with when it's built, but we're not quite there yet.
Are we particularly bad at this? Well, compared to other countries?
So how do we get here is the question they asked. And there's basically kind of two answers to that. It's one, this is what happens to mega projects. And I think that there's probably a reasonable body of scholarship out there that suggests that, you know, not necessarily constricted to Ireland, that mega projects tend to go over time and over budget. And then there's another totally contrary school of thought, which is that this happens in Ireland and to this hospital because of fecklessness, indifference, state waste, government, you know, poor decision making on behalf of government, and, you know, as in all these things, somewhere in the middle, in the fudge zone, elements of both are probably true, you know. I think that...
And actually, to give them a little bit of credit, but not too much, but there has been issues. There was the ill-fated attempt to put it in the Mater site, which was refused by An Bord Pleanála. There was several months of construction halt during COVID. Yeah. There was the economic crash, which probably delayed things as well from the time that they originally, you know, were planning this thing. A very badly designed, you know, procurement process and planning process as well.
I can accept all that, but three times the original projected cost is a little bit more. I mean, I find myself trying to shape this stuff into some more. The scale is so large. I start thinking about.
There's a whole debate about the location, and, you know, it's city centre site is kind of confined, difficult enough to build in, you know, not necessarily the best location for parents either. The debate went on for years, but did that add to the cost as well? You know, it's been the guts of 20 years of debate about this thing.
Irish Times from somebody pointing out that Dennis O'Brien relieved himself of the Beacon Hospital, which is a private hospital in the south of the city for 400 million, I think, was the price. And if you looked at the cost per bed, now it's probably not a like-for-like comparison at all, and there are probably all kinds of facilities which are required in this new hospital. But still, the price per bed difference was pretty extraordinary. It was about five times as much in the Children's Hospital.
Is this a version of the give it to Michael O'Leary, let Michael O'Leary run the government, let Dennis O'Brien run the HSE?
I'm not making any comment whatsoever on that.
I think that the thing about the Children's Hospital, like, standing now probably in the last kind of 10% of this saga, because at some point the last brick will be laid and the thing will be commissioned and children will go into it and it will become much less of a thing. But there's no kind of saving it from a political point of view now. It's like it's a signifier of state or governmental inefficiency. It's a political sunken cost that I was writing during the week. So, like, the best you can hope for now is that you get it open before the general election. I was talking to someone.
That's not going to happen.
So no, I don't think so.
It's not going
to happen. And I was talking to someone who was involved at a senior level in the whole process during the week, and I was like, you know, Taoiseach Mary Lou McDonald opening the Children's Hospital, and they're just like, please, no, don't say that. That
would
be the worst.
Well, Gerard does make the point that this, you know, clearly inefficient structure which was set up to deliver it did achieve one of its purposes, which it kind of insulated the politicians from it. So a number of ministers for health, including Leo Varadkar and Simon Harris, are sort of detached from it.
Four governments since this thing was mooted, and actually... The idea of a single children's hospital was first mooted in the 1990s. But if we're since things got serious about it, it encompassed the Fianna Fáil Green government, Fine Gael Labour, minority Fine Gael, now the current coalition. You know, everyone has their paws on this to some degree. Except Sinn Féin, actually, sort of would be an irony if it was a Taoiseach Mary Lou McDonald that ended up opening this thing and had the chance to kick the other parties at the same time.
Opened by a Sinn Féin government.
We'll leave it there for the moment. We'll be back after this.
At AJ Products, we're dedicated to delivering intelligent solutions tailored exclusively for your business needs. Spanning offices, warehouses, industries, workshops, schools and public spaces. Specialising in warehouse and project planning, we bring efficiency and sustainability to the forefront. Our offerings include versatile storage solutions and comprehensive office project design and implementation. With over 45 years of experience, we stand Grant as your trusted partner in smart B2B solutions. To explore all we have to offer, visit ajproducts.ie and elevate your business with AJ Products.
And you're very welcome back. The Social Democrats are holding their annual conference this weekend. What kind of shape are the Social Democrats in?
Yeah, they're okay. Yeah, they're pretty cheerful about themselves going into this. Talking a piece in tomorrow's paper, Saturday's paper, interview with Holly Cairns, and kind of looking at the state of the party as it goes into its first national conference / you know, what we'd normally understand to be an Ardesh, since she was installed as leader. And I think it's first in-person one for quite a while. I think they had one during COVID. But they're feeling relatively cheerful about themselves and, so
they got,
and about
they
the world.
They got a bit of a pole bounce
They got a serious pole bounce in March, just after Holly Cairns was installed as leader. They went up to 9% in one poll. That was reflected in our own poll of June, I think, 2023. They went up to 5%. I mean, since then, they haven't demonstrated any degree of that being a kind of permanent situation, and depending on what poll you look at, they kind of roughly split in two. Two of the pollsters kind of have them serially in and around 5 or above, and two of them, including ourselves, have them more in the kind of 2 to 4 to 5 bracket. But based on the evidence of our polling, you know, there's nothing to suggest that they're kind of consistently in the 5 plus bracket that would credibly put them in the space of being, you know, at least on the evidence of polling, the leader of that kind of smaller group of left parties.
They're basically neck and neck, or certainly neck well neck. Within the margin of error.
But that being said, they consider themselves to be in a relatively good position for a couple of reasons. Some of them structural, because they obviously had a very strong 2020 general election. Returning 6 TDs, that meant that they got a lot more resources, financial and otherwise. They consider themselves to be more organised now. They have a new Gen Sec in. They consider themselves to have a lot more resources for planning for the local and Europeans, and ultimately for the general. They're running, I think, in every European constituency. They're going to run in as many locals as possible. But like,
they don't really have, well, they don't have any contenders in the European elections, do they? That are likely to be.
Well, I mean,
in the
their bailiwick really is the East Coast and Dublin. So, I mean, you'd have to say that Dublin is their best shout. And Sinead Gibney, the former Chief Executive of the Human Rights and Equality Commission, looks like to be the candidate there. You know, it's kind of a situation where, not to dwell too long on the Dublin question, but whoever of the Green, Labour, Soc Dem managed to stay ahead of the other two, there'd probably be a path for them maybe to a seat. But
so there's a centre-left vote there.
We'd have to unseat Claire Daly somehow, though, you know, and be competing with Sinn Féin.
It's far from a gimme for any of those small parties, but whichever of the three of them is ahead of the other two.
But
the three of those
are really head-to-head against each other, aren't they? Labour, Social Democrats and Greens, and will be fighting for the last seat or the second last seat in a lot of constituencies.
Yeah, and this to bring it back to you know, the mood of the party, or the challenge that faces the party now, notwithstanding how enthusiastic they are, you would have to have one eye on the polling, which hasn't been stellar, or at least hasn't kind of consolidated that immediate kind of hollyhop, as people called it. But now is kind of their chance to transform the success of 2020 into something more lasting.
So how do they do that?
Well, they win more seats. They just have to win more seats. Like, I mean, they have to.
Do they have to tell a more convincing story of what it is to be a social, like, in a very fragmented political landscape, to be a social democrat?
Well, maybe not. Like, I mean, that's certainly a kind of bubble-level criticism that they can be a little bit woolly about, you know, what is particularly special about the social democrats, and that they prefer to focus more tightly on the social democrats is change, and the social democrats is hope and enthusiasm and trust.
It often boils down to the social democrats is not Labour Party that took part in that austerity government that everyone didn't like.
Yeah.
You know, that's
less scary,
which is
than the
shares. Not necessarily a compelling call to vote. You know?
Well, we'll find out. And sorry, I'm sure we're the Social Democrats all here, they'd say we have loads of policies, and they do. But like, you know, if you were to distill the message down, you know, there is that kind of maybe bit of wooliness. We will find out if that's enough in the eyes of voters, you know, to translate into more seats. And if it is, then maybe they can propel themselves beyond and into the kind of next level and become a serious player when it comes to, you know, the next government
and so
formation, but there's a lot of conditionals there. And then there's the question of, like, I was asking Holly Cairns the day before yesterday when I interviewed her, you know, how serious are you about being in government? She was like, absolutely, we want to be in government.
Well,
you
know, exactly,
but the question is
what kind of
like, when that comes to pass and everyone sits in after the next general election, there will be a protracted process of everyone talking to everyone. How long do they stay in? What kind of purity tests do they set for being involved in a government? Or do they kind of say, right, we'll be a bit like the Greens, you know, we'll get along with a lot of stuff if we get 3 or 4 signifier kind of things. I suspect that they might be a little more on the kind of on the purity test end of things. But look, it remains to be seen. I think the point, I mean, is the point is that the time is now to either kind of move on to the next level, well, or indeed, you're just kind of in the pack.
Given that the party, I'm slightly oversimplifying the nature of how the party came about, but it largely came about by people who were dissatisfied at the start with Labour's performance in government and the excessive concessions as they saw them to Fine Gael.
I mean, including two of their own TDs,
two former leaders were former members of the Labour Party.
Keane was a Labour Party member at some point.
So that's what they were, and there's always been that dynamic within what used to be a single party, which was Labour, you know, a coalition, anti-coalition kind of a thing. So in a way, that's manifested itself into an individual party at this point. I suppose one of the things I wonder is, you know, Labour in the olden days, when you had the 2.5 party system, had about 10% of the vote at least. They could kind of count on that. And that's there now, except it's split between two parties. And does that mean that kind of part of the political spectrum ends up being badly served in terms of the seats you get in the end?
I don't know. I mean, it's a perennial question as well as to whether they'll kind of merge. And I did ask that.
It was a one word answer.
I said, is your thinking of moving? It was a 2 word answer. Is your thinking evolving, not evolving?
Both Labour and the Social Democrats have the same problem as well in terms of, will they get even half their seats back after the next election? You know, all of these smaller left parties have relied on personalities within certain constituencies. In the Social Democrats' case, Catherine Murphy and Roisin Shorthall would probably be solid if they run again, and they say their intention is to run again. But you know, they are of a different generation. You know, if they might decide to bow out, Holly Cairns by no means guaranteed to get her seat back. Yeah. It's Cork South West is not traditional left wing territory. You know, Jennifer Whitmore is in a smaller Wicklow constituency than previously. It's going to be the constituency of death the next election. The only one, in fact, that has maybe an easy enough path back to re-election is Keane O'Callaghan in Dublin Bay North. You have two sitting TDs there saying they're leaving, Richard Bruton and Sean Haughey. Eoin O'Riordan, if he got elected for the European Parliament for Labour, would mean there's 3 seats free in a 5-seat constituency. So, you know, he's got perhaps the easiest path, although he wouldn't thank anyone for saying it, to re-election. But like, similar on the Labour side, they all have risky seats, you know. So that's a big problem. If their critical mass might be much reduced.
But it is probably fair to say that Labour are in worse shape. Isn't it? I mean, looking. I mean, I know that, you know, we're all within the margin of error here, but they seem to be a point or two behind the Soc Dems. And I dug into the numbers underneath the poll last week, and the Social Democrats voters are more urban. They're younger.
They get 0% in Connacht Ulster.
Yeah. So they're not going to get any seats in Connacht.
You would have said they weren't going to get any seats in Cork South West.
But they do have a younger, you know, they seem like a younger, fresher version of what Labour has been trying to offer, don't they?
Yeah, they do.
Yeah. Okay. And there it is.
Well, that's why they should merge. You get the younger voters go after the Social Democrats and the older voters that vote for Labour guys. Angeles, and everyone's happy, you know?
Okay, well, a last question on that. Maybe you didn't ask her this. Whatever about a merger, even some kind of an electoral acknowledgement, alliance, you know, there's only one or two places, and you mentioned one of them, where Keane O'Callaghan is, where they're going head to head with sitting TDs.
What, as in transfer, like an official or quasi-official transfer?
Some sort of
transfer left-ish.
Yeah, to maximise what you might call the Social Democratic vote,
I'd be surprised. There seems to be a good degree of antipathy, particularly from the Social Democrat side towards Labour, who just kind of think that the only party that would benefit from that would be Labour.
They would consider their own brand compromised if they're saying, oh, give Labour the second preference there. That's zero chance of happening, I think.
Okay, all right. So every Friday this time, we pick an article that took our fancy over the course of the week from irishtimes.com. Cormac, you were looking at a piece about the Irish ambassador's, to my eyes, rather palatial residence in Washington, but not palatial enough.
Well, yeah, Jack Power had a piece on Monday where he got his hands on some of the internal Department of Foreign Affairs deliberations about replacing the ambassador's residence in Washington. And the old one has gone on the market for $8 million now, €7.3 million. And the new ambassador's residence was bought for $12 million, and it's larger. It's not. It's got 9 bedrooms. You know, it's a much fancier residence, or so it seems. I mean, the old one wasn't.
Do you not have 9 bedrooms in your history?
Old one wasn't bad itself. It had 10 bathrooms and 7 fireplaces. Another house on the street was bought by by Amazon boss Jeff Bezos. I've been in the place. I mean, it probably had an old, maybe a kind of a faded stately home sort of a look about, and that was one of the criticisms in the internal documents was it was, quote, very dated, but it wasn't a bad house.
Could you describe
it
in the style of the Irish Times property supplement circa 2007?
Oh, in need of polishing in some areas, but a
generously proportioned.
Like, are we talking, you know, sort of frayed carpets, you know, stained wallpaper?
Yeah, maybe. And the internal layout wouldn't be maybe what they would want for hosting Irish American politicians and singing Danny Boy for half the nights. And is how I imagine these
soirees exactly
go.
What you want for that, isn't it?
The decision has been taken. The new residence has been bought, but very, very interesting to see what the Mandarins at Ivy House made of the old residence.
Right. The article I picked was on IrishTimes.com on Thursday, and it's the CSO from time to time upgrade the basket of consumer goods that it looks at in order to judge how inflation is going. It's always very interesting down the years. You know, way back when they started it, there would have been all kinds of things like, you know, yolks for cleaning your pipe or bicycle clips or
carbon paper
for typewriters, all that kind of stuff. And then, you know, they brought it up to date. So it's always interesting to see what they get rid of as well as what they join. So MP4 players are gone, I think, yeah.
Oh, they've got.
Yeah, there's one somewhere in the back of a drawer somewhere in my house. Yeah. All right. And the same with the digital camera, you know, that's also there. Wireless headphones are in. I would have thought they would have been in a bit earlier.
Yeah. Have you noticed that the Wirefoil headphone is making a comeback?
Yeah, there's a kind of retro.
There's a retro thing, including, it must be said, in absentia, the Irish Times political editor still has his Wirefoil headphones.
But he's not.
Doggedly. It's not for fashion reasons.
No,
though.
He's naturally
he's
retro.
He's just cheap.
Everything about him is retro and cheap.
Okay, somebody that loses gloves on a train every day, I am not getting those wireless headphones. Instantly I would lose one or both. So I don't know. Maybe I'm more suited to the old CSO index. But.
Yeah, rather grimly for our profession, one of the things that's gone out is newspaper ads. They're not judged anymore. Yeah. There was one thing I was wondering. I was walking into work today, and as always, the streets of Dublin were perfumed with the heady smell of marijuana, of people going to work, you know, getting their heads ready. Yeah. None of them heading for the Irish Times.
Didn't feature on the CSO list.
No sign of it in the CSO register. And we hear, you know, cocaine is everywhere. Why isn't it there?
Sign of the Times. I'd say the old school soap bar kind of cannabis resin might have gone out and been replaced by some hydroponic, chemically calibrated, mind-blowing substance.
Sounds to me like you know exactly what you're talking about there, Jack. What did you choose?
Jesus, okay. This is a lot less fun. Nuclear war. No, I chose Naomi O'Leary, our Europe correspondent's piece on Thursday of this week, looking at the remarks by Donald Trump about, you know, how he would effectively encourage Vladimir Putin to attack any NATO member that didn't keep up with its defense spending commitments, which is like a classic Trump, you know.
Which he actually told them, so they knew about it already, because this was he was describing what he had said to them.
Yeah, insofar as kind of an evolved Trump foreign policy can be said to exist, it's classically in that frame of, you know, viewing things as zero sum, almost a kind of mercantilist approach of like, you know, did you pay your bills? And if not, then, you know, our security blanket is ripped away, which is the phrase that Naomi used to describe the prospect of this. But I think in the context of, you know, both the Taoiseach and the Taoiseach being in Munich for the security conference for the first time, in the context of this morning's news about Alexei Navalny dying, the ongoing war in Ukraine, it just feeds into this broader consideration that we've been having in the paper and, you know, everyone in Europe has been having and we've had in this podcast several times, a broader consideration of what exactly is the current kind of European security stance and what are the kind of outworkings of that for, in our context, small neutral countries, but what does it all mean?
There are very few small neutral countries in Ireland now. There's fewer neutral countries than there used to be in Europe, and I found it interesting in the coverage that the question of the EU and the question of NATO become increasingly blurred or almost used interchangeably, and I wonder what that means.
And one interesting thing that it wasn't in the Irish Times, but I read this week that there's a move to have a European Commissioner for Defence apparently underway, which is favoured by Ursula von der Leyen, which is interesting as well. And it wouldn't be a kind of,
be giving that one to Ireland anyway.
No, they wouldn't. But it wouldn't necessarily be a kind of coordinating military role or anything like that. Like, you're not about to create some kind of European super army. But it would be a logistics person who would kind of look, oh, you know, do we have enough bullet factories for if and when the shooting war starts? You know, what are our strategic vulnerabilities when it comes to defense?
The underlying reality is that even if Donald Trump doesn't win, which, you know, we'll wait and see what happens with that, that there are broader underlying trends that the United States is moving towards a much more isolationist posture, and the post-war dispensation seems to be coming to an end.
Yeah, and that dispensation was always, you know, in broad strokes, European political harmony, or at least common enterprise underpinned by American military might, and something about that is shifting. And what comes next, you know, TBC, but I suppose that's what they're...
One thing that struck me was, despite his somewhat encouraging remarks towards Vladimir Putin, the Trump remarks, that is, Putin has apparently backed Joe Biden to be his preferred winner in the election.
Do you believe him, Cormac?
I presume that's an argument made in good faith. Yeah,
you know, this is the thing. He seems to think he'd be more reliable, but yes, I mean that sort of an intervention, from Putin would have to be looked at with some skepticism. But certainly, on the surface, Trump's remarks didn't do him any favors with Vlad.
We'll leave you with that shocking revelation that Vladimir Putin sometimes lies. We'll leave it at that for the weekend. Thanks so much to Jack and to Cormac for joining us. Have a great weekend. We'll be back after that. Thanks to our producer, Declan Conlon, and our engineer, JJ Vernon. See you soon.